Welcome to the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast, where we talk with nurses working at the intersection of health and the environment. My name is Beth Shank, a registered nurse from Missoula, Montana, and hosting today's podcast. Today, our guest is Kathy Curtis. Kathy is the executive director for Clean and Healthy New York and an outspoken advocate for safe chemicals. Kathy, tell us about yourself and your interest in environmental health and nursing.
Well, Beth, I got involved as a young mom of young children because somebody came to my door and they were telling me about toxic waste dumps that were nearby. And I thought I was a pretty informed and involved in my community person, but I didn't know anything about them. And they were like, well, yeah, they're not going to put up big neon signs saying, you know, toxic waste dump, build your house here. So I got involved, and it was like peeling an onion. The more I found out, the more there was to find out. And I just felt very strongly like something's got to be done. Somebody's got to do something about this. And given that, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, rather than staying working on legacy contamination like toxic waste dumps, you know, we've done our best in the environmental health field to get ahead of the curve and prevent the use of and creation of toxic waste dumps of the future.
So what were some of the chemicals at that time? And I guess how long ago was that? Because you've been working on this for a long time. And what were some of the chemicals of concern in that waste dump?
It was over 30 years ago. I'm going to say 1986 when I joined this group and got their newsletters and, you know, wrote letters and made phone calls and then actually went and worked for them as a field representative, doing the same job that somebody who came to my door did, talking to area residents. And so that was 1986, and I started working in this field in 1988, so it'll be 30 years this year.
Wow, congratulations. How has that intersected with your nursing? Because I know you're also an LPN.
Yes, well, similarly, in the medical profession, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So I just extended that outward to, you know, to the world, basically. And, it saves money. It saves wear and tear on humans. It's just a better approach to health. And I do look at the policies that I've worked the hardest to advance, both in government and in the corporate world, on a local, state, and federal level, as disease prevention initiatives.
Right, so a really strong link to health, which yeah, you then have some credibility to interpret for the public. Right. Tell us a bit about some of these issues and policies, particularly that you've worked on. I know a little bit about it, but please tell us some more.
Sure. The standard environmental approach, environmental conservation approach, is and the way that people often think about pollution or toxic chemicals getting into the environment is out of a smokestack or out of a pipe into a river or being hauled by a truck and then dumped somewhere. So that air, water, and soil contamination is certainly a big problem, and it's very important. But oddly, the vast majority of the toxic chemicals that leaves a manufacturing facility is in the products that we all use every day, whether it's a perm solution for your hair or a paint stripper to refinish a piece of furniture or car seat for your infant, you name it. That's where the chemicals are. And that's not really tracked the same way that people who have permits to release into the air, water, and soil are tracked. So it's an unknown quantity. It's over 90% of the toxic chemicals, but it's not, the flow of them through commerce is not really well tracked. So we have tested lots of products and, tested humans, biomonitored them for a lot of chemicals, and also tested various ways in which chemicals come off of products and get into our bodies, like on our hands and through dust in the house that we inhale and ingest. And so it's very science-based and evidence-based that there's a very strong pull thread from products that we're surrounded by and use every day, and toxic trespass into our bodies and subsequent health effects.
So has that been that's astonishing, actually, your statement about 90% of chemicals are really not well tracked. But and so how tell us how you've been effective with advocacy. Is this a strong message about health and about our lack of knowledge, consumers' lack of knowledge about these chemicals? What have been some of your pushbacks? I know that the TSCA reform was a very hard effort. And just tell us a bit more about that.
Sure. I think that you're right, Beth, that most people assume that if a product is on the store shelf, it's safe. And it's been fully vetted, and that nothing could be further from the truth. And the recent efforts to revise the Toxic Substances Control Act was supposed to address that, but it naturally, like any legislative effort, it was a compromise. And in a perfect world, it could work pretty well if you know, over a long period of time. That's the problem, really, is the slowness with which chemicals would be evaluated and potentially restricted under the new scheme. But given the current administration, we cannot hold out to hope that it is even going to work well at that slow pace that we had ideally hoped for. So it's still incumbent upon people and state governments and companies to adopt their own chemical sustainability and restriction policies in order to genuinely protect public health and the environment. Some examples include state-level efforts to restrict toxic flame retardant chemicals that have found their way into our daily lives. In fact, I defy any of us to get through the day without being exposed to a flame retardant, either in our transportation or our clinical setting or our home, our vehicle, you name it. And several states have taken action to restrict the worst of those chemicals. Also, disclosure is something that is never preempted under the existing TSCA, which does preempt state action in some respects. To any chemical that the EPA is looking at, a state can't take action on, or has made a decision on, the state can't go farther than the federal government. But disclosure is always up for grabs, and several states have adopted policies to require the disclosure of ingredients or chemicals in children's products, cleaning products, etc. And lots of folks are now looking at personal care products, because we all clean and we all put, even men use shaving cream and toothpaste and shampoo, etc. We all, and a lot of those are absorbed right through our, largest respiratory organ, our skin, directly into the body. So, and then knowledge is power. And if people need to disclose, hi, we're using this chemical X, and it guess what? It's a carcinogen and a reproductive toxicant. Then consumers will make different choices, and companies will reformulate in order to avoid having to disclose that health threat to their consumer.
That's a question I have. Do you think that consumer pressure is an effective method? I sometimes feel like, just with, a nursing allegiance to also speak for those who can't speak for themselves, sometimes the consumer pressure is left to those who have means or have access to educational materials, and not everyone does. So I feel like, that's only part of the answer. But how effective do you think that is?
I agree with both. I agree that it's effective and that it's only part of the answer. We really can't shop, eat, exercise, etc., our way out of this problem. We need policies that protect everyone and set an even playing field and protect people even when they don't realize they're being protected. And, but the power of the marketplace is a powerful thing. I know that during the recent economic downturn back in the 2008 and 9 and even 10, a lot of companies closed. A lot of companies went out of business. But companies like Seventh Generation and Burt's Bees, and that have as their mission driven, part of their innate mission is to be transparent about what they're doing and use only the safest and healthiest ingredients, they experienced double-digit growth during that period. So companies are starting to realize that it makes good business sense. It's not about being altruistic. It's about giving people what they want. And I would say that there is a heightened awareness generally in the populace about potential threats lurking in common products than there once was.
Yeah, I feel that way too. Do you have any advice or what can you tell us about protections or lack thereof in imported products?
It's interesting you should raise imported products, Beth, because there used to be a mechanism by which companies that were using chemicals that have been banned or phased out voluntarily, even in the United States, like we've been hearing a lot about this perfluorinated chemical that is not being made in the United States anymore. But we really have no idea whether or not it's still coming into the country in the products that are being imported. And there used to be a mechanism by which companies would have to tell the EPA and apply and do what they call a SNR, or a significant new use rule, and test and disclose, and it would be pricey. And so there was a deterrent to using chemicals for import in products into the United States that had been restricted or banned here, because it was trouble. It was a lot of trouble. But that was actually removed during the recent TSCA revision. So, and let's face it, if you look around any given room, the majority of the contents of the clothing we wear, the furniture we sit on, and everything else comes from out, is imported. We have a very unfavorable balance of trade in this country. And most of the things that we buy come from out of the country. So to have that that deterrent lifted and to not require disclosure of what's in these products, it leaves it up to, advocate scientists to test them, or organizations that, are working on these issues to do that research themselves. It's not an easy thing to find out. They don't have to tell us. It's the wild, wild west out there.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have, let's talk just a little bit about nurses' exposures. And my area of focus is in hospitals, so acute care. And I'm aware of some of the common chemicals that nurses are exposed to, and have read and quote that nurses are the second most exposed profession, second to janitorial staff. Can you talk about that a bit in terms of some of the same chemicals, phthalates, flame retardants, pharmaceuticals?
Yes. One good example of that actually is triclosan, which is it's a pesticide, but it's used as an antibacterial. And even though studies have proven that it's no more effective in killing germs than appropriate and effective hand washing, it still exposed a lot of people for a long time. And nurses, I would say, wash their hands more than anybody. And so even when they're not in the clinical setting anymore, because it's become such a habit for us to just wash our hands. So triclosan is an example of a toxic pesticide that nurses have been disproportionately exposed to. I'd say the bisphenols in certain clinical settings. Let's say you're reading a monitor, on a monitor on a woman that's in labor, and the baby monitor that is being printed out, or any monitor that has a printout of paper. That paper contains bisphenols in the ink. So that if you're touching that, and then you go and eat your sandwich or eat your apple without washing your hands, that gets, into our bodies as well. And the flame retardants, usually large settings, period, whether it's a hotel or a college dormitory, big buildings like that have different flammability standards that are more difficult to meet without adding a lot of neurotoxic and endocrine-disrupting flame retardant chemicals, organohalogens. And hospitals especially, because many of the patients are not ambulatory, they would not be able to get out if there were a fire. So it's even worse than a dormitory or a hotel it's both large occupancy and, you know, more fragile occupants. So, you know, there's been a lot of use of flame retardants in hospital settings. Yeah. And and some of the medications in, for example, oncology are toxic, and oncology nurses are exposed to them naturally disproportionately than even other nurses. So those are a few examples.
Yeah. Well, it sure speaks to the idea that clinicians, as a matter of their practice, and I'd say this about nurses for sure, because that's where my focus is, but I think it would extend to pharmacists, to physicians, to others who deal with some of these chemicals and are exposed to them regularly, that clinicians perhaps have an obligation to address these practice impacts, so to sort of clean up their practice, even though they may not feel like they have a lot a lot of influence there. But I often argue that, well, nurses certainly do, because there are so many of us. What would you say about clinicians' roles in this area of chemicals and exposures?
Well, I think that's where it's got to begin. I mean, on the one hand, if you're not doing it for yourself, do it for your patients. But on the other hand, if you're not doing it for your patients, do it for yourself. And so it's important to connect with whoever's buying the stuff for your clinical setting in your facility, and provide them with evidence-based information about, for example, phthalates in vinyl and how it comes off and gets into not only, a neonatal intensive care nurse's body, but also the neonate itself, who's has an IV, for example, receiving IV treatment. And, and start to educate the purchasers, because if they don't buy it, it won't be in the clinical setting. So that's on a small and very large scale. Sometimes the clinician is the decision maker in smaller clinical settings.
Right. Yeah.
Healthcare Without Harm is a good resource for that information for practice health.
Right. And I know on the Healthcare Without Harm site and Practice Green Health, there are sections on environmentally preferable purchasing. Right. I also know from working in healthcare that it is a hard area to address, partly because, I always feel like we need a little bit more data in terms of the health impacts, such that we could measure the intensity of the impacts, because it feels like it gets watered down. And it's more of a risk than an impact. And we can't spend money on just risk reduction if we haven't actually seen something happen. Those sorts of things. Because oftentimes these exposures, like you said, in neonates, the results happen years later sometimes.
Right. And that by then you have no idea what to attribute it to. Yeah. They're not acute outcomes.
Exactly.
That's right. And that's the thing about the ubiquity of this exposure. It's, coming from everywhere.
Yeah.
The bisphenols, that's another thing I defy folks to get through the day without getting exposed to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Annie, the Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments, because you have been there since the start. Why were you interested in getting involved with Annie?
Because I think that I couldn't be more excited about Annie and the role that they have to play. Nurses are the most trusted profession. They're the most credible spokespeople. They're excellent at translating complex science into easily understood and salient information to the public in general. And they're passionate. I mean, they really are, tigresses when it comes to protecting public health and caring for their patients. So who better, it's just, it was such an amazing nexus of opportunity, like a huge light bulb went off, skyrockets. Such a great idea.
That's cool. And you lead the advocacy and policy work group. What sort of stuff do you work on with Annie?
Well, it's ebbed and flowed a lot over the years. We tend to go where the action is and where we believe we can do the most good. For a while, it was the Toxic Substances Control Act reform that we did a lot of work on, and can really be proud of our influence in that outcome. And then, you know, we worked a lot on the President Obama's Clean Power Plan, going around to states. We do a lot of work to educate nurses, which I know the education work group does as well, but all not just about an issue, but about how to advocate yourself. So that's one of the common underlying themes of the policy and advocacy work group, is to really empower nurses to be more effective in being heard and having their voices, you know, having the nurse perspective represented in the halls of power, whether it's on a local, state, or federal level. And climate has become a very big priority of the work group as well, because climate and health. I don't think people think about climate as having impact on public health so much as, you know, the polar bears or the rising sea, you know, seawater and that kind of thing. But it really does have a lot of impact. Higher temperatures affects everybody, from the elderly to the youngest to pregnant women. And a lot of the disease-borne pathogens and disease vectors are empowered and strengthened by climate change. Everything from ticks to poison ivy, you know, are traveling faster and becoming more virulent. Poison ivy, people who are never, you know, it's becoming a common adult onset allergy. People who are never allergic to it, they are now. And people who were allergic to it, they can get such severe cases where it's actually life-threatening.
It's amazing. So you've worked a lot on a variety of environmental health issues. The longest period of time is on chemicals, but as you say, you're working a little bit more on climate right now. What would you say is your biggest concern these days about environment and health?
Well, my biggest concern is that there seems to be something to worry about nearly hourly on a daily basis. We're in an information era in which we're being bombarded with information. Good or bad information is, you know, is subject to debate, but information nonetheless. And people have an emotional response to it and tend to shut down. Like, don't bum me out. I can't listen to any more of that. And people feel disempowered. They feel like it's too much. And so that's a concern that I have. And, you know, by the same token, people who have also been complacent for years, if not decades, are now off the couch and getting more involved and, you know, becoming engaged.
So the concern is a little bit like where do we focus and how to keep people engaged and working toward health?
Where to put our attention, you know, such that we can drive wedges and have momentum and actually make it, where can we make the biggest difference, you know, in our personal lives, in our communities, in our clinical settings, in our states, in our country, you know.
And,
in our world.
And because you've been working at this for a while and you've been very successful, do you have some lessons that you could share about addressing that concern, particularly because you really work with a lot of people and you've done a lot of teaching and a lot of coaching? What would you say have been particularly helpful approaches?
Well, it's a 100 years war. You can't expect instant gratification. And there's nothing that we can win that they can't take away from us, sadly. So, you know, you have to be in it for the long haul and sort of pace yourself. The other thing I would say is that politicians or elected officials are people too, and they're really no different. What motivates them and what drives them and what they care about or, you know, think about all day, every day is no different from you or me. And that, you know, everyone should sort of get themselves accustomed to talking to leaders and being on advisory boards or, you know, regulatory bodies and, you know, get out there and get dirty. That's what I'd say.
Cool. Do you have specific advice that you would give to nurses, especially nurses who are in school now learning about some of this or in their early days of their career?
I suggest to especially the younger nurses or nurses that are in the beginning of their career to find out all that they can about this and its intersectionality with every other factor that affects disease, whether it's stress, diet, et cetera. That, you know, if you're missing this boat, then you're missing a really huge piece of the puzzle. And also to, you know, to set aside a tiny bit of time. A little bit goes a long way. If everybody gave a day a year, you know, aggregate over the period of the year, to voice what they're thinking. It's not like people don't think, oh, that's awful, or, oh, gee, that's great. But the next step is to take the next step and do something. Sign the petition, make the phone call, send the email.
Do something to get involved and speak up. That sounds terrific. And also with state nursing organizations and places where people, where nurses are employed. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that's terrific. Do you have ways you'd like to say that nurses can get involved right now, and at least with Annie or with Clean and Healthy New York or any other thing?
Yeah. Oh, Beth, you have to. Okay. So if you go to the Annie website, which is envirn.org, there is an action on there right now to the EPA to send a letter to Scott Pruitt. So the letter is already written. You're welcome to add stuff, but you could just go click and then bam, you know, you fill out a little tiny, I am me, here's my email, and you click and off your letter goes. In New York is about to become the first state in the country to require the disclosure of ingredients in cleaning products. Mm. And not only do they have to tell us the intentionally added ingredients, but also the contaminants. And a lot of times there's a lot hidden there in the contaminants that are byproducts of the manufacturing process or in the, you know, the base, like even the water that they used to make the product. So those are important too. And fragrances have just been listed, when they are listed at all, as just the word fragrance. And that can be up to 50 ingredients right there. And, you know, the phthalates you mentioned earlier are often featured in fragrance. So not only are they going to have to tell us about the intentionally added ingredients, but also the contaminants. And they're going to have to let us know if those ingredients are any of on any of a list of dozens of authoritative government lists of hazards. So carcinogen, reproductive toxicant, asthmogen, which is a big challenge for nurses in the clinical setting, and you know, a number of other.
Wow, that is terrific. Does that mean, can I buy my products from New York just so I can see?
Well, you know what? That's the good news is, Beth, is that everyone will have that information.
Uh-huh.
These are national brands, so they're not going to reformulate for New York and then make something different for everybody else. And hopefully, like, they'll have a year-ish to before they have to disclose. So hopefully a number of companies will reformulate to stop using those toxic chemicals, because that's what we really want, right? Please direct your call to Governor Cuomo's switchboard. The number is 518-474-8390. Ask him to release the final instructions to cleansing product makers on how to provide full disclosure of all hazardous ingredients in cleaning products. You're not going to get the governor, so don't worry. Don't be intimidated. Make the call. Take 60 seconds to do both of these actions. To the EPA Administrator Pruitt and Governor Cuomo, would take a total of 2 minutes. And boy, will you feel good about yourself.
And also, it sounds like a great opportunity to thank New York for their leadership here. This is terrific.
This is true. It is going to be not only the first in the country, but a really strong, strong law. So.
Well, that's fantastic, Kathy. Thank you so much for your work over the past few decades and your leadership. I know that you've been a prominent player in all of these decisions and this advocacy for healthier chemicals. Is there anything else you'd like to add today?
No, Beth, just thank you for having me and giving me an opportunity to hold forth on my favorite subject.
You bet. Well, thank you all for listening to the Nurses for Healthy Environments podcast. Check us out at environ.org and please leave a review for us on Apple Podcasts on iTunes. Talk to you next time. Mm-hmm.